would be gathered, and the abbot would chant, "Good morning," and the monks would all respond,
"Good morning."
They were tired monks. And so this went on day after day, week after week, month after month in a monastery. And one morning the abbot came in, as he usually did, and said, "Good morning." And a lone voice from the corner of the scola responds, "Good evening." Never lost his composure, and he responded, "Someone chanted evening."
Whoa.
But you can retell it. It's my privilege to be with you here this morning.
Really? Seriously?
it fits in. I'm going to talk about the well-tempered soul. And I want to talk about that in the context of the monastic tradition and what we might learn from looking back at the monastic tradition in the West. I get a chance to speak to a number of people in a number of different places, and whatever group that I speak to, whether they be people in the professions, whether they be people in the arts, whether it be people in medicine, whether it be people who are in the trades, people are exhausted. It's interesting, we kind of even become accustomed to talking about being a wearied soul, a tired soul, so little energy that gets exchanged between people, that everyone seems to be riding on the rails of exhaustion. We shouldn't even know the terms Ambien and Lunestra, and yet that we do, that people are not well rested. David White writes this, "When your eyes are tired, the world is also tired. When your vision has gone, no part of the world can find you. Time to go into the dark, where the night has eyes to recognize its own. There you can be sure that you are not beyond love. Sometimes it takes darkness and the sweet confinement of your aloneness to learn. Anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. Anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you." What I've learned over the years in terms of speaking to groups of people is that I always thought that people were really interested in what I had to say, and then realized that the research tells us within that tomorrow at this time we will not remember 85% of what we heard today. And so what happens, you have this kind of this image that people are empty vessels and that you have to pour all these things into them. And I have a sense now that people's lives are not empty at all. I think people's lives are very full. Your life and my life is very, very, very full of relationships and responsibilities. And because it's very, very full, sometimes we forget about the really good stuff, about that stuff that nourishes us, the level of which our souls are made of. I'm diabetic. And one of the things I do to try to remain healthy is that I keep a half gallon of apple cider, fresh crushed apple cider, which you can get across the river in La Crescent, Minnesota, the apple capital of the world, of Minnesota. And you can reach in there about 9 o'clock at night and you get this half gallon of apple cider right underneath, you just look at it. And then, there's those grapes that have been fermenting in a bottle. Okay, I'll have the apple cider. But before you pour yourself a glass of apple cider, what do? Before you uncap it and pour yourself a glass, what do? Shake it up. And why do you shake it up? Because all that good stuff is at the bottom. And I think that what happens is that our lives are so full of so much, as Greg reminded us last night, we forget about the good stuff. And every once in a while, you got to get all shook up. And I can give you the exact time of this. It was 22 months ago this month. 22 months ago this month, I was off of a terrible, would send me out to speak to our alumni. And they would send me out with one of my beloved colleagues and friends, Earl Medary. I had the privilege, and with those of us who are in higher education, I have the privilege of having a student who then becomes a friend and then becomes a colleague. It's really a great gift that takes place, that the teaching life is so interconnected. And 22 months ago, they sent me out, and it was generally the Tom and Earl show. Well, Earl was one with the real talent. Yeah, I mean, he played the guitar, he sang beautifully, he was passionate when he spoke, and I kind of filled in with these corny jokes. But that 22 months ago, I was just a Tom show because Earl was battling stage 4 liver cancer. And so there I was in the Fox River Valley speaking at a hotel to our alumni, and I was giving it my best shot, doing whatever I could to represent the university and to do what I was expected to do without my very good friend. And now it's 8 o'clock at night, and I'm at the Paper Valley Inn in Appleton, Wisconsin. I haven't eaten supper, and I don't have a place to stay for the night. And the next day, I have to go and do another workshop for faculty. And I'm walking through the lobby of the hotel, and I bump into those gentlemen. Excuse me, sir. Mark! Tom! It's my brother Mark. He's a district attorney of Adams County here in Wisconsin. And I hope none of you have ever met him. And I said, what are you doing here? He said, I'm here for a state DA convention. He said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm here giving a talk for the terrible. I said, what are you doing now? He says, I was going to Subway to get a sandwich. I said, listen, we're old enough. Let's go in the tavern. So we went in the tavern, and we sat down, and we had supper. And he looked at me and said, where are you staying today? I said, I don't have a place to stay. He said, why don't you come to my room? Well, the state's already paid for a room for me. He said, if you don't mind sleeping with me, I have a king-size bed. I said, not at all. So I went and got my stuff and met up in his room. And we were talking for a while, and it was time to go to bed, so we both got up, took our medication. And then they got into this big bed together, turned off the light. Instantly, we're 12 and 11 again. Instantly, we're 12 and 11 again. The last time we had slept together in the same bed, we're 12 and 11, and we start giggling like little boys. And we start talking about our lives. We talked about our mother and our father who have both died. We talked about our brothers and our sisters. We talked about our spouses and our children. We remembered our friends and the good work that we've been given for a lifetime. And in the dark that night, remember, for a lifetime, we've been loved and cherished and very blessed. The good stuff. Good stuff. Now, just begin where we're accompanying strangers, but by the end, we'll become a community of scholars. Just talk with the person right next to you. What's some of the good stuff in your life right now? With the person right next to you, what's some of the good stuff in your life right now?
I'd say the good stuff in my life right now is before we say it.
Silence, please. And what did you become aware of as you talk to the person right next to you about good stuff in your life? 30 seconds of silence, what did you become aware of? Thank you. We hear from a couple of you. What did you become aware of as people talk about good stuff?
What a blessing children are in our lives.
Children.
Relationships.
You said that about a student who becomes your friend and your colleague. I'm here with one.
Blessing.
Great blessing.
Meaningful work.
Good stuff. Just like Greg told us last night, it's not the size of our house, it's not our Lexus. It's the good stuff. Well-tempered soul recognize the good stuff, and yet so often it is covered up and forgotten because I think we have too much stuff and too little temperance. Too much technology, so little love. Too much responsibility, so little peace. Too much on the to-do list, so little contemplation. Too much stuff, so little simplicity. Too much pressure, so little leisure. Too much stress, so little joy. Too much despair, so little hope. In a society which is so focused on that which is new, isn't it a gift for all of us to come together to reflect on the true? Isn't it great to be considered old school and to contemplate the virtue of temperance, then to be able to share the fruits of our contemplation with one another? So I thank my colleague Rick Kite for calling us together to do just that. In my college years at St. John's University, I was in pre-monk training. Really just starting a monastic vocation. I was impressed by the monks, and then I got introduced to Thomas Merton, and I'd spend long evenings on the campus. It was a campus of about 1,500 acres, and there were lakes on the campus, and that at night, on Saturday nights, because there was not a lot to do, I'd walk up and I'd go in a monastic cemetery with another couple of friends, and we'd sit on the abbot's tombs and talk with each other. And it was rather an amazing kind of a thing that we were really kind of discerning our vocation and the larger questions of the universe with one another in a community. And then I was introduced then in terms of the monastic tradition to be part of that community that you would take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And in the Benedictine tradition, silence. I was doing pretty well with poverty, chastity, and obedience. Silence, probably not. But one of the things in that monastic tradition, introduced for the first time to the wisdom of the desert mothers and fathers, kind of brought back to the West, if you will, by Merton himself. And I just love those names of the desert mothers and fathers of the 3rd and 4th century. Pombo, Pachamus, Athanasius, Arsenius. Well, I think that what they understood was the power of temperance. Temperance, a virtue which is not individual, but must be practiced communally. Abbot Pombo questioned Abbot Anthony, saying, "What ought I to do?" And the elder replied, "Have no confidence in your own virtuousness. Do not worry about a thing once it has been done. Control your tongue and control your belly." Control your tongue and control your belly. What would happen to shout radio if they would control their tongues? Control your tongues and appetites. An elder said, "Cut off from yourself rash confidence and control your tongue and your belly and abstain from wine. And if anyone speak to you about any matter, do not argue with him. But if he speaks rightly, say yes. If he speaks wrongly, say to him, you know what you are saying, but do not argue with him about the things he has said. Thus your mind will be at peace." A well-tempered soul. It's wonderful wisdom that comes from us, from people who spend time in silence. But what they discovered is that to live intentionally in a community, there had to be rules for living. Saint Benedict writes about this, who writes the first rule for Western monasticism in the West. Much of what he wrote was borrowed from Pachamus and also then from Saint Basil the Great. And what they understood is still contemporary today, that in order to love God and to love others, we must be able to practice temperance. And so the point that I'd like to make, or try to make this morning, is that poverty, chastity, and obedience, the vowed life, is important for us to be able to live together in community with each other. Poverty is the virtue which limits our dependence on things by calling us to lives of simplicity, which allows for freedom and choice. As Greg made the point so powerfully last night, less stuff equals more time. Less stuff equals more time. I'd love to use this example. What used to come in the Sunday paper? The news. What comes in the Sunday paper now? A litany, if you will. Kmart, Walmart, Target, Farm and Fleet, Macy's, Menards. How much of that stuff do you need? None of it. You already own two of everything. You can buy it cheaper at your neighbor's rummage sale. Less stuff equals more time. One of the interesting things is about poverty is that it limits the choice to live in, to live the vow of poverty, is that the desires of the individual are subservient to the needs of the community. The desires of the individual are subservient to the needs of the community. Even practiced here at Viterbo University, the only reason we are here today is because the women who founded this university, the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, practiced these vows that allowed for the community to grow. People who taught at Viterbo University for years, the sisters taught here, and would receive no salary. Their salary was paid back to the convent. And then the sisters each received $25. I mean, this was up until the 1990s. The sisters who live in the houses across the street on Mississippi Street, $25. These women with doctoral degrees, with publications, with great ability, shared a newspaper between six apartments. And they were sharing the La Crosse Tribune. It wasn't like the New York Times. What's really wonderful in the convent yet today, they have what's called their heritage collection. That when a sister dies, all of her clothing goes to the heritage collection. My good friend, Sister Lorian, one time I saw her, I said, Lorian, that's a beautiful skirt you got on. Oh, she said, I got it. It's my heritage collection. Handed on from one of her sisters. Isn't that rather amazing? That what you do is that your own needs are subservient. And what happened was, what with their salaries? They were donated back to the university to keep us alive. What a powerful tradition built on vow of poverty. A sense in terms of simplicity for the common good. Benedict knew this. Talked about this in terms of limiting ourselves to live more simply. Here it is in the 4th century writing about on the quality of food. In this rule, it's just amazing because he talks about all aspects of living together in community. I was reading this, I thought this would be a great in-service material for a college faculty. What is to live in community? And he writes, making allowances for the infirmities of different persons, we believe that for the daily meal, both at the sixth and ninth hour, two kinds of cooked food are sufficient at all meals, so that he who hath perchance cannot eat of one may make his meal of the other. Let two kinds of cooked food, therefore, be sufficient for all the brethren, and if there be fruit or fresh vegetables, a third may be added. Let a pound of bread be sufficient for the day, whether there only be one meal or dinner and supper. If they are to eat supper, let a third part of the pound be received by the cellier and be given out at supper. If, however, work has been especially hard, it is left to the discretion and power of the abbot to add something, if he think fit, barring above all other every excess, that a monk be not overtaken by indigestion. For nothing is so contrary to Christians as excess. As the Lord says, see that your hearts be not overcharged with surfeiting. And let that same quantity of food, however, not be served out to young children, but less than to the older ones, observing measure in all things. But let all, except the very weak and the sick, abstain altogether from eating flesh of four-footed animals. Healthy diet. Grains, fresh fruits, vegetables, but don't overeat. Live in community so that you know everything is sufficient. I would like to say here, right here and right now, poverty is not a virtue unless it is chosen. Three blocks away from here, we have a little house called the Place of Grace, and people come because they are hungry, because they do not have access to food, because they are unemployed or sick and living on fixed incomes. There is no virtue in that. But to choose to live as part of a community and to limit my wants, to suppress my own desires for a greater good, I think is a great virtue. On the quantity of drink. Everyone has his proper gift from God, one after this matter and another after that. It is with some hesitation, therefore, that we determine the measure of nourishment for others. However, making allowance for the weakness of the infirm, we think one hermina of wine a day is sufficient for each one. That's about 3 liters. But to whom God grant the endurance of abstinence, abstinence, let them know that they will have their special reward. If the circumstances of the place, of the work, or the summer's heat should require more, let that depend on the judgment of the superior, who must above all things see to it that excess of drunkenness does not creep in. Saying, not, you don't have to give up wine. I was thinking, this monastic vocation, I can handle it. Then we got the silence. Although we read that wine is not at all proper for monks, yet because monks in our times cannot be persuaded of this, let's agree to this, at least that we do not drink to satiety, but sparingly, because wine maketh even wise men fall off. But where the poverty of the place will not permit the aforementioned measure to be had, but much less, or none at all, let those who live there bless God and murmur not. This we charge above all things, that they live without murmuring. Live without murmuring. Don't complain about what you do not have, but give that up. And what you do have, never to excess. I was thinking about how is it that I could start talking to college-age students on college campuses where binge drinking is out of control. How do we begin to suppress our needs and our wants, practice temperance? But we cannot do it unless we live within a sense of community. And this is what Benedict understood. One could not do this alone. Even those who were hermits or would choose to live apart from the community were connected to the community by prayer. If you've ever been to Gethsemane, where Thomas Merton had his cottage. Merton had his cottage separate from the main monastery, but he would always walk back and forth to pick up his goods, to join the community for prayer and for occasional meals, to be committed to the community. The second virtue that they talk about in the tradition is that of chastity. Chastity. Properly understood, that the virtue of chastity is emotional honesty. To be chaste is to be emotionally honest in all of our relationships. So what does that mean? Well, it's what Greg told us last night. You can't have 400 friends. And yet to live without any friends is a great danger. To practice chastity is to have friends in which I practice temperance, choosing relationships. How many people can I be emotionally honest with each and every day? Control your belly and your tongue. Discipline your desire. A community cannot survive without temperate relationships where chaste living is practiced. In the early days of the Franciscan community, when the sisters were gathered together, and what's really amazing about this is that our floors in the main building, Murphy Center, were all parquet oak. And what would happen is that when the sisters came back from mission, where they'd be teaching during the summers, they hand polished all the wooden floors. Now, one of the interesting things about it was this, as I was thinking about this, they had maybe as many as 150 young women between the ages of 18 and 25. They had to find things for them to do. And so they worked together. And one of the things that they were warned against were particular friendships. A friendship in which just two people would separate themselves or isolate themselves from the community. So the notion in terms of chastity was that to have friends, but not just particular friends, but within the community, so where you would practice that vow of chastity in terms of honest relationships. And finally, to practice the virtue of obedience. The proposal of obedience is that in a healthy community, there needs to be obedience to each other. Obedience from the Latin word obedere, which means to listen. To temporarily limit my speech and practice silence, which allows me to listen to others, especially the divine. How often in teaching might I be reminded of this? How much and how often in teaching do I speak too much and listen too little? How much is too much when my voice is the only one to be heard in the room? One of the interesting things in the monastic community was to practice a vow of silence because they understood that idle chatter could be harmful. That sometimes in terms of fewer words are more. And isn't it rather interesting that when we enter into an intimate relationship with another person, somebody that we really love, we don't need words to be comfortable in each other's presence, to recognize the silence that is between us. Mary Oliver has a beautiful poem that says this. Praying, It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention. Then patch a few words together and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks and a silence in which another may speak. A doorway into thanks and a silence in which another voice may speak. Simplicity, emotional honesty, thoughtful communication, words and silence. These are vows that allow for a life in community, which is only possible if we commit ourselves to being temperate. To be temperate allows us to reclaim, to remember, and celebrate the good stuff in our lives. And in closing, go back to the desert one last time. Once they asked Abbot Agatho, which is greater, bodily asceticism or watchfulness over the interior soul? And the elder said, a person is like a tree. Their bodily works are like the leaves of the tree, but interior self-custody is like the fruits. Since then, it is written that every tree not bearing good fruit shall be cut down and cast into the fire. We must take all care to bear this fruit, which is the custody of the mind. But we also need leaves to cover and adorn us, and that means good works done with the aid of the body. The Abbot Agatho was wise in understanding and tireless in his work and ready for everything. He applied himself energetically to manual labor and was sparing in his food and clothing. He practiced temperance. Thank you.
We'll do both presentations here, and then we'll do question and answers together. And then, did you want to?
Check it out.